Okay.
Tend to sleep rhythm sometimes to oversleep, sometimes not to get there. And so that the school would sometimes just let it go, and then there's a tendency to run out of spell. And so I pushed through a deal that the school administration could suspend a student for cause for a maximum of 3 days. But only the school board could expel. And to someone to expel, that the student had to show up at school board meeting with at least one parent, and at the school board meetings then. I tended to be the chief inquisitor, because it didn't solve anything to expel the youngster unless we knew why the youngster was having problems and his side of it. And I remember once one of the, Adam Levitt's boys, or I think it was Frank, and he was a seventh grader. And so he was in for his inquisition sometimes on an hour of it. And so I kept asking, and he pointed out, well, school is boring, you had to get up. And I let into it. And at that time, Adam was working at the lab. And I pointed out that all the years that Adam worked at the lab, some of the things that Adam did were boring. And also that when I had originally, as part of the Geological Survey, had hired Adam to repair the weasels after the Navy went out, I said, Adam couldn't read. He would take the maintenance manual, and he would look at the pictures, and he would figure it out. He said, Adam doesn't want you there. And if he can go to a boring job, if he can get up every day and go, he said, it's only fair that you do that. And Adam's wife, Edna, is there. So, after the Inquisition was over, two or three, Adam and Edna both shook my hand. 2 years later, I gave the commencement talk for the ninth grade as a commissioner from Juneau Vista. And here with the carnation in his buttonhole, I think it was Frank. He was there. And afterwards, came up to me and shook my head and said, thank you. So, there were things like that. Another thing is swimming pool. Congress was considering appropriations for a new high school. And Julia Hansen was head of the Interior Subcommittee. She was from the state of Washington. And it came up the high school, and the BIA was the swimming pool. The BIA was not in favor of it. And I had insisted that, it had to have a swimming pool. My argument was, Barrow, there are no firefighting systems. Wooden buildings. averaging 4 drownings and 4 fire deaths per year. And that no way did I want that. If with a swimming pool, there's a chance that the kids can learn to swim, even though in cold water it's not for long. And I said, and then it can be the fire system. They're fighting fire. Julia Hansen bought it. These arguments, and sometimes the school boards met until 3 o'clock in the morning, including sometimes Prudhoe people would go over there to the school board meeting when they were visiting Barrow and heard that, you know, I was going over, they'd want to go too. But that, shall we say, that argument is pretty well ensconced in Barrow. And the idea that kids have to have room, because see, when the kids went out, they were having trouble. My kids were going to school there. Now, my kids had advantages. Number one, it was just assumed that an education, you know, in the family discussions and whatnot, it was assumed. Another thing is, they had room to study. They had books to read. And the other thing is that each summer they would go out to terrorize the Dreadnoughts. And they'd lost both their grandfathers. But they saw things down south. Mm-hmm. So that when they would read something, they could have a connect with it. For instance, St. Kenny, when we got the lab, I had the lab boat, Natchez built. St. Kenny down with John's predecessor, to see how the boat was coming along. Kenny, you know, he knew about tall buildings. But when he got to Seattle, he was shocked how tall he was. Pete Sulik. You know, I mean, one of the greatest naturalists and hunters. Scared to death first time he saw a horse. An animal that big must be vicious. Teacher that had been in the Pribilofs, native teacher. Been in the Pribilofs 20 years. And was invited to a meeting in Juneau. And they picked her up and were taking her to town. In those days, the road to town, you know, went ran by a dairy. She saw the cow in the distance, and all, I mean, first cow she'd ever seen. And I mean, this is, it was something big. A little further along, there's a cow up next to the fence. And she was horrified at how big it was. Mm-hmm. And so the area representative there, well, how big did you think the cow was? Oh, a bit bigger than the dog. Here she's been teaching for 20 years. Mm-hmm. This is a change. It has occurred in your lifetime with people there. Mm-hmm. So many things that they didn't know about. And the movies, for instance, westerns, mm-hmm. were great for educational items. And I've sent some of the old John Wayne movies to China for students there trying to learn English. Mm-hmm. John Wayne spoke very slowly. That was important.
Yeah.
And, of course, there was action, you know.
Right.
And, but there, I know that there's one professor that I asked him, he's from Central Europe. How did you learn your English? Watching John Wayne movies. And the movie theater used to be the big thing. Getting back, you know, I would send people out to essentially for safety purposes, also to help them, you know, just in the routine things. Phil Sivulik. I first hired him from British Geological Survey on civil service. And then filling out the forms, well, you know, have you ever been arrested? One thing, another, well, to explain the, how you're hiring a fellow who's served a couple, 3 months in the pokey. And I pointed out, you know, okay, drunk and disorderly, and so on. That was a perfectly acceptable social thing, and that he should not, that shouldn't be held against him, and it wasn't. But it's just things like that. I don't know if you're aware that if you die in Fairbanks, Christmas time, you can wait until June to be buried.
Yeah, I do know.
Or in Anchorage. But at Barrow, 4 or 5 days after you, year round, it's only on the North Slope. And this occurred when I went up there, just over off the east end of the runway there. I used to have a temperature cable. I had a temperature cable under the runway in that little pond right alongside. I was all over in the country with the temperature cables, go out and read them weekly. But out there, just to the off the to the south from the near the northern end of the, or the eastern end of the runway, there was one ravine, and I had a temperature cable. I went out there, 27 skulls long, and. The lab, there was a tendency to bring skulls in. Some, you know, would like none. But there along the ravine, they were from the measles epidemic. And so there's this tendency. Whenever I saw one, plain sight in the lab, I told the people, I never want to see a skull. I said, if you have one that you picked up in the file cabinet, I won't be looking in your file cabinet. But you better not have one on the shelf. And then one time I saw one that was not too aged. So I was chatting with Kenny. And usually I could kind of chat in an abstract way with Kenny. Still can't. I said, you know, Kenny, down south, and they bury people about 6 feet. And then they're never disturbed. And did you know up here in permafrost, it's pretty hard. He said, you know, in Fairbanks, it's the turn of the century. They had a lot of people from essentially Yugoslavia area. And I said, you know, those people, a shift, 8 feet on a side, 8 feet deep, because they had to put shafts down to get to the gravel so they could get at the gold. I said, digging through the permafrost. I said, one fella up top side, pulling it up and sharpening picks, and another fella down with the pick and shovel. And I said, you know, here in permafrost, it's just about like permafrost in Fairbanks. Another thing, in between those nice and polygons, ice ones, this is pure ice. But I think that natives do every bit as good as those old Yugoslavs came over at the turn of the century. So, it's way now. If it were in the wintertime, and if it was a tragedy, the fire, you know, several, we had the earth auger, and it would auger 32 inches in diameter, and you take three of those, and then knock out the partitions. Well, this is what we did for Lou Crable. He was 6'4", real big box. And we go out there, 17th of January. Forget the exact year. I can tell you the day, but years occasionally get a little easy. And he's out there, I think it was 64. But it wasn't quite midnight. We're standing out there, it's 47 below, and the people are chipping out to extend it. But he was buried, and I was wearing caribou socks and slippers, and I froze my heels. But out there in the tent. But Lou's sister was coming up. And Wayne was late. Funeral was set for 2 o'clock. Presbyterian Church. And, but sister coming in. So I said, you know, they don't have open coffins. I said, well, have it so it's open, you know, all the canvas and the tacks, everything except. And, but, no, they had no heat. Yeah, it was definitely January of 64. I just put together somebody being there. And I told the minister, I said, now when I come in with the lady, that'll be the signal to start. It was about 3:15, people have been freezing their tails there in church. They're waiting for the funeral. So I set up with the family and the four kids. And so take the body back to, you know, they had that room behind, kind of a rec room. And Here, John was sitting with this Navy facilities officer. That's the reason I remember from Seattle. And the youngster started to follow the mother and her aunt back. But I kept them with me. Then you hear this bang, bang as they're hammering it. And I mean, that really resounded through the church. And John said, this facility fell and grabbed him. And the arm said, my God, that's so final. And so they then went out and froze people. But meanwhile, at the house, of course, Gladys and her mother and sister were there. And of course, Lou's sister came up. We know no place to stay, so invited Gladys and the four kids come out and stay with us. And so I would plunk myself down on the sofa, get ready to go to work. And nine kids come up and kiss me goodbye to go to work. And it was the four youngsters were all cousins, and you know, adopted. And since you're going to make this public, I think I'll let the family background go.
That's fine.
Should we take a break?
Sure, if you want.
He drew, and he wasn't so good at it because he shot himself in the thigh and the bullet lodged in the calf. And she carved that one out okay.
Ooh.
But then she had another patient just before he died. And that one, she lost him. He'd been playing Russian roulette about 5 o'clock in the morning. So I've always, you know, pointed out that she's not been all that successful. And you know, I feel that I can argue with her. Getting back to, you know, some of the things that happened. I don't know if you are aware of the meaning of maybe.
No.
Maybe can mean yes, no, or maybe. And you have to understand the context in which it's said. I know one time with Pete Sublet, he had a project came in and they wanted to go out and find a squirrel colony that they could sort of monitor over period of a few years. And so they had picked an area down in one of the rivers that they wanted to go visit for the summer. So I had Pete in. And I told Pete what the project was all about. And pointed out to this area that they wanted to visit. And Pete listened. And he said, well, you know, when I was a boy, and there was a an area over here. He said that is good for good, maybe a good place for work. And so I said, why don't we take a break?
Okay. Yeah, it was Pete and the squirrels.
Well, Pete, listen. And he pointed to another place in the map. And I said, well, when he was a young fellow, that that was a pretty good place to get squirrels. That he got quite a few there for jackets. And so the fellow kept coming back. Well, he wanted to know about this place. And so Pete started talking about, well, you know, when he was a young fellow over here. And so that there was some discussion, and discussion, you know, as to, well, when we go out. And I said, Pete, what would I do if maybe you didn't come back home tomorrow night? Oh, maybe she understands. And so a little bit more, Pete went away. The fellow said, well, when are we going to go out here? And, I said, not going there. He said, there are no squirrels there. He said, the squirrels are over here. And I said, weather permitting, we'll go out tomorrow and Pete will go along with you. And Pete had never said anything derogatory. He described the area a little bit, but nothing derogatory about it. But he always kept coming back. And I'd, you know, said, well, what would I say? And, well, maybe she'd understand. And so, in other words, the weather's good tomorrow. You go over here where Pete said to go, because there are no squirrels here. And this is sort of a way of being able to translate it. For instance, you know, the possessive is not used much in the old, among the old generation. For instance, I never heard Pete say anything such as my wife. He'd always say the mother or the oldest boy or something of that nature. In other words, the courtesy that at least I used to associate with the Oriental. And when I was there 3 years ago, that I found was still quite applicable. And as to how to get along. If you would ask, for instance, Pete was one time, Pete, other than animal caretaker, which ended up to be his full-time job, was asked, he'd been, in a sense, janitor, whatnot, but he had been asked by the shop foreman to clean the fire escape in the second floor. There's a balcony and a ladder down the old concerts. And so, fine. And so, next day, the fellow ask Pete again to clean the fire escape. Third day, he started asking. He said, Pete, do you know what a fire escape is? Pete said, no. But when he said fire, so he'd gone out and cleaned all the walks around, but not on the second floor, because he didn't know. So that when you talked, I got so that I would talk in the sort of the same approach. And if I wanted a definite answer about something, I would ask it two or three times in a bit different way and come up with an answer. Now, this was the case with many of them. And I might mention that now the apprentice aircraft and engine mechanic under Frank Waits, big tall black fellow, there was a young AIN means gold. And of course the Chinese they write the last names first.
Oh, they do.
So my translation of it is Golden Max. But they sent me a photo of him, and so it was something that kind of came as a bit of a surprise, and I married my wife, gave him a little infant Garmin. It had to be blue. And so I told him, that blue was for boys. And when for Christmas present, I sent him two little outfits. One with red pants. And the other, because his father wants him to grow up speaking English. It had ABCs across it. And the other was a little gold suit. Well, in China culture, red is good luck,
mm-hmm.
and yellow is power.
Uh-huh.
So that was, I definitely won those two colors,
mm-hmm.
and it with sort of that in mind. They paid me a nice compliment when I was there. They said that I understood people, and I pointed out that was a legacy from Barrow. To understand people, and that was an important one. Where were we on the construction of the lab?
You just said that the old building was too small, and there was the idea to construct a new one.
Yeah. So the construction up there, we argued with the Navy because we wanted more lab, and they had a construction factor of 4.74 times as costly as it would be to construct in Richmond, Virginia. And so we had to, and I was arguing for a factor of 2. And finally, the facilities captain in the Office of Naval Research said that he wasn't going to put up with any more arguments, that we would use a factor of 3. And so that's the because we had $3 million to work with. The laboratory, as it sits, actually cost $2.3 million. Because on a lot of things, we sort of gold-plated, for instance, it's got double flooring now. But anyway, the construction and the, I hired a contractor to do the architectural work. And the first design came out, and I had 25 pages, single-spaced, of criticism. Sent it to the Navy. The Navy, of course, sent it on to the architect. Came back, and I still had 17 pages. So they finally sent the deputy chief, the naval research up, with the idea that either Brewer was crazy or they needed a new architect. So he spent 4 days and came back and paid off the architect and told the Navy to design in-house. And that's the building that you see there now. It was started in the after shiplift in 68. We had put in the piling. All the piling were put in by Kenny Tuvok's crew, with Frankie doing most of the work. There are 527 piling beneath that building, and the corners were surveyed in. And I told Kenny that I wanted the piling 15 feet deep, and I wanted to be able to look down a row of piling and never see more than one piling. For instance, if you go to the hospital and you look at underneath and you see the piling and you see all the piling going down. Sometimes the piling don't even meet the sills that they're supposed to support. The lab has many features in, and we had a Swedish architect over shortly after it was constructed, and he'd been touring the state. And his comment was that it was one of only two buildings in Alaska that had been environmentally designed. Mm. And that was well during the construction, they started constructing the fall and constructed right on through the winter. Because the thing that we did is we got the walls up and used visqueen and heaters. And that was in the winter of 68. That shortly became the standard way of construction in Alaska, Fairbanks and Anchorage. And it was dedicated in the spring of 69. But I'm very proud of that building, because even today, with all the usage that it's had for more than a quarter century, the laboratory is still a mighty good, solid building. And a lot of things in the actual construction ended up as an applied research project, in effect. It was during that winter of constructing that we had a retired teacher from Oregon up there visiting. He hadn't been there in many, many years. And he talked a mile a minute, and it hard to get in word edgewise. And I'd gone out in the old library and talked to him for a while. And, you know, he's extremely interested in education. I said, well, would you like to go through the new lab? Oh, yeah, yeah. So I called over to the lab shop for him. And I told him that, well, I'd like to have him send over one of the fellows to show this teacher through. So here came one of the fellows. up to the lab. Area to the stairs, came in, was standing there waiting. I motioned him over and got a word in edgewise. I said, you know, this fella's gonna show you through. Bill Brower here. And the other fella, Dave Brower here. And I pulled the same stunt on them that had happened to Harry and Noe. And two brothers, actually half brothers in each case. And so I took them over and went through. During the construction, there came to be a lot of appreciation as to how it was constructed. You notice that the grating outside is for the gravel in the wintertime, and that the wooden rails to hold on to so that your fingers don't get stuck. And the other thing is that the outer door opens inward.
Right.
That's against fire regulations in the state of Alaska.
It is?
They're all supposed to open, all doors open outwards in case of fire.
Hmm.
And I fought the Navy and I fought the state over that. And the reason for it is that barrel, 2 inches of snow behind the door, hard packed, will keep you from getting the door open.
That's true.
And it was just that. And I mentioned Lou Frabel is buried up there. He'd gone in, his family, he and his wife had adopted 4 youngsters. And he went in to try to rescue. They were already out. But he ended up trapped and could not get out the back door because it had been drifted shut. But the laboratory, I won that argument. I told them at Prudhoe and whatnot. They fought the argument on that. The thing's still in the books, but and with the Navy, as far as they were concerned, it was my fight. They were not going, they pointed out, hey, that's not the way it's supposed to be. You know, it's supposed to be panic bars and you get out.
Right.
And I said, panic bars up here on the outer door and you're panicked in. And so that is the way that it went. There were a lot of things like that are built into that laboratory. And as I say, then the other new construction is with the lab built the hangar, the powerhouse in camp, the building out there, that was transmitter building, that is now being used by the borough and the actually not by the borough, but by UIC as a headquarters. And there is the building at the dump built with the incinerator, which really never worked. All those, but as I say, I was poor administrator. I spent my time on that sort of thing, or in the science. And John Schindler got caught with the paperwork. Speaking of John, he was up there on a project of where you're supposed to spend the summer at Peters Lake, which he never got to that summer. But I hired him at the end of the summer as administrative assistant. And he went on the payroll on the 15th of September. Well, I was out. We were established in Arliss 1. So I was aboard an icebreaker. And I got back, I think, about the 21st or 22nd. Helicoptered into shore. And it, shall we say, I had promised the skipper a drink. Because the Navy, you know, U.S. Navy, you don't care. Carry alcohol on board. And so this was fine. I came in to see if I had any mail. Mary Lou was down south at the time. And he came in about 8:30. Meanwhile, Dr. Wood, Chuck Keim, who was head of the journalism department at the university, and a consultant from Stanford were at Merrill to see us, and Dr. Wood had wanted the consultant to see Merrill. And so this was fine. They were waiting for us. I came in, and Dr. Wood was there, and the consultant. In comes the skipper. And I said, well, Dr. Wood, I promised the skipper a drink. Do you want to come down to hunt with us? Fine. And so down to hunt, John came. John was mixing martinis as his first official duty. At 9 a.m. Well, he continued mixing till at noon. Dr. Wood decided maybe they'd better go up to lunch. But I'd also promised the senior officers on board. So the skipper had really enjoyed his martinis, and so he sacked out on the bunk. The senior officers came ashore by boat, and so for a drink. 5 o'clock, they went back on ship with the junior officers coming ashore. So about 9:30, sent them out, and they were with the skipper. He was the vertical by then, and when the junior officers, they were 6-inch plank into the boat from the shore. One of them fell in the drink, but they fished him out. And so about 9:45, John calls up to the lab, tell Dr. Wood, well, that the Navy was all back aboard ship and we're ready for conversation. Dr. Wood said, well, we'll do that in the morning. So that was John's first day on the job. And so getting back to some of the early days, you know, they used to have a 4th of July. And they didn't have fireworks in Merrill. So by 8 o'clock in the morning, you'd hear these big booms, you know. We were in Cleveland camp, big ones. Oh, in the village, they were setting off half sticks of dynamite as firecrackers. And then, you know, big celebration. And oftentimes it was bring out the muktuk, like, you know, during Nellicutuk. And then they would have, starting about 10 o'clock, the various races. So, for the ladies, 60-yard dash. Winner, Annie Brower. Three-legged race, still 60 yards. Winner, Annie Brower. She was only a grandmother. And by that time, and they'd get a kick out of it. If there was a And it was usually softball that you camp against the village. And along about noon, you look out and see how the weather was. And then you get some unsuspecting pigeon and you make a bet as to who would win the ball game. And if it was a nice sunny day, always bet on the camp. And if it was spitting snow and sleet and a bit of rain, always bet on the village to win. And I mean, it was just like clockwork. They as to whether you won or lost the bet, because if you bet that way, invariably you won. And that's the way it went, because they essentially in camp you had a greater experience. But in the village, you had the greater competition. Mm-hmm. And also a willingness. Another thing is that I started in, I think it was 1959, that there was only the highest grade there was, ninth grade. And if you wanted to go on, well, you either went to Mount Edgewood or to Oregon or to Kansas or high school. Mm-hmm. And generally the kids were gone for 4 years, which really was a problem, of course, one that I ran into then later myself. Mm-hmm. And so I made the remark that any of the kids who were going to college or were going for their senior year to high school and give a job. In those days, I had about 12 jobs a year for young fellas, you know, expediter types and painters and so on, slap paint on the buildings. And so this was the deal. Well, at the end of 3 years, I had to discontinue the guarantee of a job, because it went from, you know, I get 3, 4, 5 there. It went up to, no way that I could hire those that, the numbers that had been going out to either go to college or to finish high school. And the, basically those that were going to Mount Edgewood. And so it, and then, in other words, it was just that period in which there was an explosion for more education. Now, the early ones going out to college, very often they were Bible schools. And so that had meant the change. Well, one of those who was got a job at paint was Eugene Brower. When he became mayor, I understand that he issued an edict that no city building would have yellow paint. He had painted the ends of so many buildings yellow that he was determined that there would not be any. Now, the lab colors for the vehicles on a visit in 57, a Navy captain had complained about couldn't find his way around because those Quonsets were all the same color. So I decided, well, okay, we would paint the ends of all the buildings yellow. And all Wanigan's yellow. And then the weasel cabs and vehicle cabs, red and yellow. And so Max Britton, a scientific officer from Atlanta, came up and he saw the key, I mean, painted and splashed around in vehicles, and said, well, when are those navy colors? Without a comment, I told him, oh, the high visibility. And, of course, in the case of yellow, yes. But in the case of red, no. Because red, half a mile off, shows black.
Mm-hmm.
And the other thing is that red and yellow were chosen. Those are the first two colors I left. And, but as if you go, this is around the Arctic world. The further north that you go, the gaudier the paint. This is worldwide because it's white for so much of the year that people want to see color. And it's like at the lab. When the lab was built, I told them that I wanted bright colors, pastel, and they chip up the, you know, the color scheme. And I would say, no, no, and so on. And so this was fine in the dorm rooms.
Mm-hmm.
Each door, different color. And the contractor was building the new lab. And of course we had a Navy construction inspector, a civilian.
Mm-hmm.
And there was actually an officer came up too. And, but the contractor complained to the Navy inspector about here. He had to go out and buy a quart of paint that cost him so much, I've forgotten outlandish sum, just because of that damned color. And so on. And the Naval Facilities officer called me and talked about it the same day. And yes. Well, what did I think of the color scheme? Oh, I said, it's pretty good, but it's not as bright as I really like it. And, but over at Prudhoe, all the construction the same way. And the same idea. Now, getting in the, back to the high school, or to the school advisory board. People were complaining, you know, about the BIA system. And so the Commissioner of Indian Affairs set up a deal, okay, we have an election for an advisory school board. 5 members. And so there were nominations in the village. And there were 6 natives and 3 non-natives nominated. And there was no campaign. But in the election, 3 non-natives won. To natives. The commissioner was up later that summer. He asked me about it. He said, well, why did they do that? He says, I realized that you were one of those elected, but why did they vote that way? And I said, well, they're more sophisticated than people down south. I said, They didn't know what a school board was supposed to do. And they had some non-natives who had been here more than 10 years. And people figured that they knew what a school board did because they all came from down south. They'd been here more than 10 years, so they knew what the people wanted. And, for instance, those elected were Bobby Fischer, Senior. I say that, you know, because of your age. And because Al Shanks, myself, and Joe Upickson. And let's see if we can. Who's the other? Anyway, four of them, and I said on top of that, you know, four of them were employees at the laboratory. So he took that. Well, with the school board, you know, it was for 1 year, elections. Well, at the end of the year, the school board reminded Barrow Village Council, and pretty much nothing happened. A month or so later, school board reminded council, time to open lunch. Nothing happened. Another month, another reminder. This time, got a response. They came back and they said they had their school board, and they'd let the school board know when it was time for an election. Well, time went on. And it came out, well, okay, you can have 7. But we didn't have an election. I nominated Annie Brower, Eddie Hubbs. So they became school board members. Well, it was 66 it was first came out. The first election for school board came with the establishment of the borough in 72. And I was still on the school board even though I'd been in Juneau for almost a year. Yeah. And but as far as they were concerned, I had school board.